Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul. BlakeRadio.com.
This is Dr. Jennifer Daniels, and you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Blake Radio Network. And this is Tuesday, April 1st, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And the show is coming to you from sunny, hot, and hopefully quiet Panama. So, tonight's topic, why medications can never be safe. I'm going to discuss tonight the methods used to determine drug safety and the information anyone, doctors, patients, anyone needs to know in order to recommend or use a substance safely, and how this information is systematically either withheld from doctors and patients or just never determined at all. And so tonight, hopefully you'll learn how to make your therapy natural otherwise. Extremely safe. So here we go. Now, the main philosophy is about healing. So, of course, in medical school, our philosophy is it's worth dying in order to heal. The patient stops short of the deadly blow, why? He's a coward. He's not serious. He doesn't really want to get well. And so, any and all interventions are justified. Because, of course, you're trying to kill and solve that disease. Never mind, the patient may be standing in the way and may actually die as well. But one should never shy away from a drug just because it's hazardous or dangerous. After all, we are doctors with special powers and judgment, and that's that. So that's the medical philosophy. Now, since then, so let's look at a lot of alternative healers. And we've found here, especially in Panama, there's tons of alternative healers. So I was talking to one, a locally famous one, who makes his own jungle oil. And so we're talking about the different herbs locally. Well, you know, some herbs are totally safe. They're very safe to use. And they're so safe, why, you could just eat them. And then there's some herbs that are so deadly that one taste would kill you. And so there's the herbs in between that, if used properly, can give benefit. And if used improperly, can harm or kill. And so that's where the healing lies. I was absolutely shocked to hear that. Personally, it is my belief that it's actually possible to heal safely. You can actually stay in the safe zone. You don't have to risk your life or take something that you know is deadly in order to heal. So, basically, my personal philosophy is healing does not have to hurt. And so in order to have healing that does not hurt, it's important to assess the safety of a therapy and stay within the safety zone. If you cannot stay in a safety zone if you don't even know if you're hurting. And that's really the problem with most medications, that doctors use, in fact, pretty much all of them, is the safety zone has actually never been defined. And so it's not possible for the doctor to stay within that safety zone. Let us talk about what information doctors are given, and we'll talk about also what it means and what the value of that information is. One piece of information that we really been given a lot of in medical school, we're told it's very scientific, and that's the biological and plasma half-life of the medication. In other words, if you give a medication, once it reaches peak concentration in the blood, how long after that point does it take before the concentration drops to half the original concentration? And then it's assumed, by the way, not always true, but it's assumed that a half-life is stable. In other words, it's a linear thing. So if it takes 4 hours for the first half of something to leave the blood, of course, it's going to take another 4 hours for the next half of the remaining, another 4 hours for half of the remaining, and so on. But this is not always true. Some drugs don't have what's called linear kinetics. And so they leave the blood at a rate that's not linear. It means it may be 4 hours, half of the drug is gone, and it may take 6 hours for the half of the remaining to go away. This is something that's actually never considered. And so all drugs are treated as if the half-life is a fixed quantity. But let's just say that it's true. Even though it's true, a drug's half-life only tells you the time. It doesn't tell you anything else. You can have a drug with a half-life of 2 hours, but it can cause death at 6 or 10 hours. And so an excellent example of this is non-steroidal arthritis pill. This would be your Motrin, ibuprofen, Advil, that kind of stuff. Even though half the drug is gone every 2 hours, that initial dose can damage the lining of the intestine, and over the next 6 to 8 hours, a person can bleed to death. So the half-life tells you nothing about, one, how deadly the drug is, or two, what point the damage occurs. So even if you have a drug that has a short half-life, let's say 2 hours, the deadly damage is done at, say, 2.5 hours. So even though you remove the drug from the person's system, they can still go on to die as a result of even that one dose. So half-life, as a guide to a doctor in terms of the safety of the drug, is simply not valid, not a valid indicator. Yet, in medical school, doctors are told that a half-life is something that we can rely on. It's very important. The half-life lets us know the toxicity of the drug. The half-life lets us know how much time we have to get the drug out of the person's body, or if we have to. If we have a short half-life, as in Motrin of 2 hours, then you don't need to really worry if the person shows up after the 4-hour point because their body has already removed the drug from the system. Whereas if a drug of half-life is 20 hours, the patient shows up at the 5-hour point, why then, of course, you want to put a tube down and suck stuff out of it. So all of that rationale, all of that logic has turned out to be totally fallible and unreliable. Because it turns out now that you can just give a person, the doctors are not doing, giving them, get this, activated charcoal. Yeah, activated charcoal and a cathartic to get rid of drugs that are believed to be in a toxic level in the person's body. So biological and plasma half-life. Honest to God, in medical school, they spend tons and tons of time discussing this parameter. And so doctors believe that once they know the half-life of a drug, by golly, they've got good information that they can use to figure it out. Another example of where the half-life is totally irrelevant is it doesn't indicate how long a patient will have to wait to see the beneficial effect. For example, it takes an average of 1,250 years to see benefit from cholesterol therapy. even though the half-life of most cholesterol medications is more or less in the 24-hour range, and takes 780 years to see benefit from hypertensive therapy, even though most hypertensive drugs have a half-life in the, certainly in the area less than a day. Now, when I say benefit, the reason we take cholesterol therapy is to prevent a heart attack. That would be the benefit of taking cholesterol therapy. The actual number, the cholesterol itself fallen, is not the benefit. The benefit is avoiding the heart attack, avoiding the deadly heart attack. And similarly with hypertensive therapy, the benefit for hypertensive therapy, now this can be disputed, but I'm going to take the patient's side on this one. The benefit of hypertensive therapy would be avoiding a deadly event, let's say a heart attack or stroke. And again, this is one that would cause you to die. So if you have a stroke and you don't die from it, then that's not a failure of your hypertensive therapy, because the hypertensive therapy is designed to prevent deadly stroke. This is interesting. So it turns out that for hypertensive therapy, you can't show any measurable increase in life expectancy over no therapy. This is shocking. But when you realize it takes 780 years to show benefit, then you realize, no wonder you might not see benefit in one lifetime, or in any lifetime, any one particular lifetime. So knowing the half-life of medication doesn't allow you to prescribe medications effectively or safely, because the safety and the effectiveness are not in any way related to the half-life. Now, the other thing that's unrelated to half-life is duration of benefit. It's unrelated to half-life. Now, this is a shocker. You would think, well, if a drug stays around for 2 hours, half of it's gone for 2 hours, that gives you half. Every 2 hours, another half is gone, giving you a quarter. Another 2 hours, another half is gone, giving you an eighth. Then, surely you have to dose this drug rather frequently, like every 2 to 4 hours, right? That's pretty much wrong. So the way it works is many antibiotics, for example, are given as one dose, and it cures the infection. The antibiotic may have a half-life of 1 day, yet the infection can be gone for weeks or even years. And so doctors are only given half-life information, a starting dose, increments to increase, and possibly a maximum dose. And so at no point do doctors get the minimum time to harm, which is a side effect. So how long does it take this drug to do harm? And then minimum time to benefit, how long does it take before the patient experiences the promised benefit? And I was always, in medical school, amazed that we were never told this. We were never told at what point the patient would experience benefit. So how long does the patient need to be on blood pressure medicine before he experiences the benefit of left heart attack? So, of course, in the absence of information, the credulous, believing, youthful mind fills in the blank and says, well, he must be protected as soon as he starts taking the medicine. Not so. This is very, very important. The other thing is side effects of the drug can be apparent in 1 hour, yet the half-life may be 16 hours. This is true of clonidine, the patch for hypertension. For duration of benefit, it's also unrelated to half-life, so as is the duration of harm. So we doctors are never told, from the time a person stops taking a medication, how long is it before they no longer experience the benefit of that medication? So this is very, very interesting. It's a lot of information that doctors just don't have. And patients aren't given. So let's take a look at ibuprofen as a good example. Ibuprofen is an over-the-counter pain medicine. It has a half-life of 2 hours, but it's dosed every 6 hours. Back in 1999, the pharmaceutical companies that made wanted to introduce drugs competing with ibuprofen and make ibuprofen relevant. So they introduced the COX inhibitors, the deadly Vioxx and Celebrex. And at that time, they came up with the figure that 17,000 deaths every year happened just because someone swallowed an arthritis pill, namely Motrin or ibuprofen in that class. Now, miraculously, this is 2014, in 2013, 2012, that number is believed to be 4,000. Nevertheless, we're looking at 4,000 deaths here. So let's see what the doctors told about NSAIDs. I said, well, you know, increased risk of heart attack. So this pain pill can increase the risk of serious heart attack and stroke, and it says can be deadly. That means people have died. And this may increase, I'm not sure, they don't know, or it may not increase the duration of use. And this is shocking. For the Celebrex and Vioxx, it's documented that the death due to heart attack is unrelated to duration of use. In other words, it often occurs in the first week the drug is used. I mean, to pay with your life for the potential 1 week of relief from arthritis? My God. I mean, what must the person have to do with that 1 week in order to make it worth dying over? Then they talk about gastrointestinal risk, which is bleeding to death. And so they're saying NSAIDs, and this is they use this word instead of the actual ibuprofen, but the class effect for any non-steroidal anti-inflammatory can cause this. And so we're saying serious gastrointestinal and stomach adverse events, including bleeding, ulceration, perforation, the hole in your stomach, which can be fatal. That means people have died. And these events can occur at any time during the use and without warning. So you can get death with the first dose, second dose, at any dose you can get, you can die. And there's no warning. You don't necessarily get pain in your stomach. And, of course, elderly people are at greater risk for serious events. Let's just call it death, because that's what we're talking about. And so what they're saying then is, next thing I think you should know is what's the maximum dose? What's the highest dose at which anyone has ever gotten any benefit? That's nice to know. As long as you're going to risk killing someone, you might want to know at what point at least they have no more potential benefit. So this comes straight from the ibuprofen people themselves. Individuals may show a better response to 3,200 milligrams a day as compared with 2,400 milligrams a day. That makes sense. Although, in well-controlled clinical trials, I mean, they did the research, patients on 3,200 did not show a better average response in terms of effectiveness. Therefore, when treating patients with this dose, we're saying that maximum benefit seems to happen at 2,400 milligrams, but go ahead and give 3,200 anyway. And the doctor should observe, that means watch, sufficient, that means enough, increased clinical benefit to offset potential increased risk. So in other words, the doctor should decide how much additional pain relief the patient gets that would make it worth dying over. This is very interesting. It seems to me that it would only make sense to ask the patient, but hey, you know what? You're at 2,400 milligrams. There's no benefit to going any higher. Although you would be more likely to die, would you like to go higher? So it seems to me that would be a reasonable conversation. But the doctor instructions say, no, you don't need to have that conversation with the patient. The doctor can decide. The doctor can watch, and he can determine for himself what is enough benefit to offset the possibility of death. So this is a backup website, www.ncbi.nationallibrarymedicine.nationalinstituteofhealth.gov. Okay. This is actually really it's a shocking. And so 62% of adults in the United States recall taking pain pills in the week prior to being surveyed. So they were of the same age in 2005, about. That's a lot of youth. But 3,243 deaths in the United States from NSAIDs. This is the present industry estimate. I'll take them at your word. I will not question that. But we ought to put this in perspective that all the vaccine-preventable diseases all together, every single one of them, kill fewer than 3,443 children. So we're going to go through vaccines, dire warnings, public service announcements to protect people from those vaccine-preventable diseases, yet we hear no such warnings or announcements about this one class of drug that's responsible for 3,443 deaths. Again, this is going to FDA.gov. I trust them, and I believe them. It's time for station identification. You are listening to Healing with Dr. Daniel on Rainbow Falls Blake Network. And I want to tell you to be sure to get your free report. Remember, it's so powerful. It could make antibiotics obsolete. If you've not gotten your report, please do go and get it. While the arthritis pills may have killed 2,443 people in the past couple of years, antibiotics every year appear to be killing very close to 75,000 people. So those are definitely ones you want to avoid. So go to vitalitycapsules.com and get your report. Now, what is it you should know about your drugs? So let me tell you what you should know about your drugs. And actually, you should know this about your herbs, too. Very, very important for you not to let your herbs off the hook on this one. Why? Because more and more herbs and supplements are actually being manufactured by pharmaceutical companies. So you really need to be aware of what's in your herbs and how safe are they. So first of all, I need to know the minimum beneficial dose. What is the lowest dose at which you're going to get the benefit? Okay, that begs the question, what is the benefit? So many people are taking cholesterol drugs, taking hypertensive drugs, taking even drugs for diabetes. They don't know what the benefit is. So you want to ask, if you're going to take a drug, what is the benefit? Even if you're going to take an herb, you want to know, what is the benefit? A lot of times you might find out that you're not really interested in the benefit. So always find out, what's the benefit? What is this drug going to accomplish for you? What is this herb going to accomplish for you? That's one thing to know. Next thing to know is the minimum dose at which this benefit is experienced. And that you can calculate by weight or other criteria relevant to the individual. Another thing to look for. Is the dose modified by some personal characteristic, either by gender or by weight or by age? If the dose is not adjusted by gender, weight, or age, then you immediately got a dangerous drug. That doesn't work. Because any drug can be okay for one weight and deadly at another weight. So if the doctor or practitioner has been instructed this drug is good for everybody at all weights, this dose, then that's a bit too casual. Next is the maximum beneficial dose. At what dose is using a higher dose of no further benefit? This is important. And then you want to know the minimum harmful dose. So what's the lowest dose at which side effects are experienced? And make no mistake about it. Side effects equals harm. So if someone says, oh, you're having a hard side effect, no, you're not. You're experiencing harm. You're experiencing a precursor to death, especially if you're taking a pharmaceutical agent. This is not trivial. So the next thing is onset of action, and that's either benefit or harm, whatever action you might experience. This is the time from the dose, to when you take the dose, to when the person experiences some type of effect. And then, as I said, you have to define the benefit. And then you want to know the minimum lethal dose. You know the minimum harmful dose. What's the minimum lethal dose? This is a curious dose. It's the lowest dose at which death has ever been known to occur. What is the lowest dose, and what's the weight of the individual who died at this dose? That is key. And once a doctor is aware of this little piece of information about a drug, it can make him a very safe prescriber. All of a sudden, he can say, you know what? I'm not feeling that high. or, you know, this person is too slender to tolerate that thing. This is a minimum lethal dose. And doctors are almost never told this dose. How I know this? Because I went to medical school because I'm a doctor. In medical school, we're told the LD50, the dose at which 50% of all who take it die. This is useless unless you want to kill half the folks you take care of. Well, unless as a patient or as an individual, you want to have a 50% chance of death. So the LD10 is a dose at which 10% of all who take it die. Again, if you're trying to be safe, this is not a useful dose because even though you stay below the LD10, you still have a very big chance of dying. Chance of death, by the way, for an American in any given year is 0.8%. So if you are looking at the LD10, you're increasing your chances of dying by more than tenfold. So the LD10 is not a useful piece of information because you don't want to die. That's not your goal. Goal is to get better. So we doctors are told the LD50. The drug companies are really generous and give us the LD10. But we never get a minimum lethal dose. And once you have a minimum lethal dose, then you really can make decisions about taking the drug. For example, if the minimum lethal dose is lower than the minimum beneficial dose, well, you've got deadly drugs. You can't take enough of it to get benefit without dying. So that's interesting to know. I mean, that's interesting. It's helpful to know. Next thing you need to know is the minimum interval at which benefit is lost if the dose is not repeated. This is very important. And so, for example, it may not be necessary to take a medication every day in order to experience the benefit. So the next thing, so the minimum interval, and next is the maximum interval at which benefit is lost. So the dose is not repeated, the next higher dose may be ineffective in any and all humans. So you want to know these two to help you understand the spacing, for example, with turpentine. The maximum interval at which benefit is received is 1 month, actually 6 weeks. So if you dose it every 6 weeks, then you can maintain the benefit. The minimum interval at which benefit is lost is 6 days. So you have this range between 6 days and 6 weeks in terms of dosing. And so an example, a pharmaceutical example of this is the SSRI, the serotonin reuptake inhibitors. These are antidepressants. Now, I'm old enough, maybe I have an old agent. When Prozac was first introduced, we doctors were told that Prozac was so good, it was so strong, that they only needed 2 doses, 5 milligrams or 10 milligrams. That was enough for everybody. And it was explained to us the brain only has so many Prozac receptors, and at 10 milligrams, everybody's receptors are totally saturated. And it needs to be taken once a day, and it takes 2 miracles to resolve depression. And no one would ever need more than 10 milligrams. Now, fast forward, so that we got that PEP speech in the 1990s. Fast forward now, 2014, what do we know? Now we're told that Prozac is no better than placebo, and it's doing nothing. Now we also see the maximum recommended dose is 80 milligrams. So the maximum beneficial dose was shared with doctors as a marketing tactic. And in retrospect, you can see it was simply a made-up number. So it was deliberately assigned a low number to give doctors and patients too a confidence in the effectiveness of the medication. And so when your doctor receives a package insert, he only gets information on the beneficial dosing. He does not get information on any of the others. This means your doctor does not have enough information to safely prescribe the medicines he's recommending. So doctors are given the least useful information about drugs, half-life, beginning dose, maximum dose. Information that does not predict long benefit or even duration of benefit. So let's look at the information that would be more useful and see if we can find it. So let's take a look at aspirin. Okay, so aspirin, and I'm going to take a look at a specified application for aspirin. And this is 81 milligrams. And you're going to take, and people are advised to take this once a day, every day. And so, what are we told? Well, we doctors are told that you start with 81 milligrams and you give it every single day. And for 81 milligrams, what are the what is the dose at which the therapeutic effect is seen? Well, we're guessing it's 81 milligrams. What's the dose at which no further benefit is achieved? Well, we're guessing it's 81 milligrams. And what's the LD10? We don't have any for aspirin. They don't give that. They don't give that. They don't give that. What about the LD50? Well, that's not good. Okay. And what about the onset to side effects? I can personally tell you that 81 milligrams, the onset to side effects is actually 24 hours. That's the onset to harm within the first 24 hours. And then the next question is, what's the duration of benefit? We take 81 milligrams a day of aspirin to prevent a second heart attack, not a first heart attack, a second heart attack. And how long do you need to take this 81 milligrams every day in order to experience that benefit? We doctors aren't told. Well, then, how long do we need to take this, if we stop the 81 milligrams, how long do we need to take the next dose? Like, uh-oh, problem over here, problem. If you stop the aspirin suddenly, you can actually experience a heart attack that you would not have had you never taken the aspirin. Well, that doesn't sound very helpful now, does it? So we have here a drug where the benefit is clearly defined. Many people think that one aspirin a day is going to keep them from having a heart attack. It only helps with the second heart attack, not the first heart attack. Then the minimum lethal dose, doctors never told what that is, although we do know that people have died if you even know them one aspirin a day. The LD10, don't know. LD50, doctor doesn't know. Not the package insert. And even the most diligent doctor is expected to read the package insert. That's pretty much the high level of knowledge on the drug. And the maximum benefit was maximum dose is 81. So all we're told is 81 milligrams. Take it or leave it for everybody. Okay. Let's take a look. I decided I would take a look at the top-selling drugs in 2013. And I decided I would take a look at the top-selling drugs. The top-selling drug is Abilify. This is shocking. Abilify is a drug for schizophrenia. It's a drug for people who hear voices and who are absolutely crazy out of their mind. This is really shocking. It would be a number one selling drug. However, as with any number one selling anything, the most important thing is that whatever it is you're treating must not be especially measurable. There's no point at which you can decide you have enough of it, and there's no point at which you can decide you do not need it. And so psychiatric drugs certainly sell that bill at the whole time. Now, what evidence do we have that Abilify is safe? Let's presume safety for a minute. They did 6-week studies in humans. They determined the maximum dose taken by a person who took it and did not die. It was 42 times the prescribed dose. Now, we don't know if this is the LD99. 99% of folks who took this dose died, and we're referring to the one who lived. We don't know if it's the LD50. So this gives us absolutely no information whatever on safety. So we have in the Abilify, I got to tell you, in the PDR here, Abilify takes up 8 pages, 3 columns each, of what appears to be 7-point print. Now, excuse me, more than 12 pages, 3 columns each, 7-point print. This is shocking. You think about this much information. And you don't reveal to the doctor the minimum lethal dose. So the doctor has no clue for Abilify. What is the lowest dose at which anyone has died? Now, he does have a clue that there have been a substantial number of deaths. Why? There's what we call a black box. There's some information here. They're surrounded in a black box. It's called a black box warning. And a drug only gets a black box warning after a certain number of documented deaths. Let's see what the black box warning for dementia. It says increased death in elderly patients with dementia. Okay? So the person's demented, and you give them Abilify because you think it's crazy and demented, that person has a pretty good chance of dying. But you don't have to figure out how big it is. And children, adolescents, and young adults, a young adult is someone who's 25 and under, so we can just say 25 and under. So taking antidepressants and other psychiatric disorders that increase risk of suicidal behavior. Now, what's suicidal behavior? I think we can agree that that's killing yourself. That sounds like it's a deadly outcome. So we have this drug here. We have no minimum lethal dose. We don't know the dose at which, the lowest dose at which anyone dies. We do have a maximum effective dose. That's good. We do say that you should not go over a certain dose here, and their dose that they seem to think is okay is 30 milligrams a day. And even though it seems to be adolescents are at a higher death rate, they say here they do have adolescent dose. They do have a pediatric dose. And I don't see an elderly dose. And so we have, I'm telling you, all of this information is just incredible information. There's full prescribing information. There's why you should use it, how you dose it, and how you administer it. You know, start low and keep going. And how to adjust the dose. I'll tell you about how to screen patients to check for people who need this drug so you can make sure that everyone who needs it is getting it. They have a special section on pediatric patients and adolescents who are at increased risk of dying, but don't worry, you can use it on them too. And they do say weight gain has been observed in adults. Okay? And this is, like I said, this is really, really shocking. And if you have a problem, if someone starts talking about they want to commit suicide, of course you should call the doctor. There's not any talk about patients stopping this drug on their own. They require special permission to stop this particular drug. And so we have just pages and pages of information. On a drug, this is the number one seller in the United States in 2013, drug number one, and your doctor doesn't have a minimum lethal dose. Next thing your doctor doesn't have for this drug is they don't tell him the odds of the benefit. So when is the person who's taking a Abilify expected to benefit? Next thing. Or even really, what the benefit is. It's not indicated. Is a person going to stop being crazy? Are they going to suddenly be able to continue college or hold a job? It's not clear what the benefit is. And then the LD10 and LD50 are not told those, even though it would be useful. But we do have information on, of course, of the drug. So we have a drug then, the doctor is really not able to use it safely because he doesn't know the lowest dose at which anyone dies. And he's not sure how to figure out the benefit. But this is a drug that the doctor is absolutely not able to prescribe safely, even though it's the number one selling drug in the United States in 2022. That's shocking. Then we have Crestor, number four selling drug in the United States. And this is by a dollar amount in sales. And they go by dollar amount in sales. Drug companies and folks who evaluate them don't mess around. They're very clear that it is all about the money. They don't even talk about numbers of people treated, numbers who benefited. This is absolutely not mentioned. want to take a break and let them know that they can phone and listen online at 914-338-0695. We have a chat room going, which is healingwithdrdaniels.chattango.com. You can join our lively conversation in the chat room. And I'll be taking questions in about 10 minutes. So definitely get your questions ready, and we'll handle questions ready. All right, Crestor. Now, this is shocking. Crestor, for those of you who don't know, is an anti-lipid medicine. It lowers cholesterol. And the reason is to reduce the chance of a heart attack. Now, what they say here is the reason to use it is if the lipids are high, why reduce them? If the lipids are high, okay? But they don't say here, to risk reduction for heart attack, stroke, and atrial vascularization procedures in patients without coming to recovery heart disease but with multiple risk factors. Okay, great. So you want to reduce a person's risk of a heart attack or stroke either during a typical procedure or just in general. That's why you're treating the person with cholesterol. Dosage administration, take it with or without food any time of day. That's nice. Anywhere between 5 and 40 milligrams once a day. That's nice. And start at 20 milligrams. And in pediatric patients, we don't recommend this for children 10 to 17 years of age. Dosages greater than 20 milligrams have not been studied, but go up to 20 milligrams, let's say. And reasons not to take it. Active living disease, women who are pregnant, and nursing mothers. So we still don't have a minimum lethal dose. Warnings and precautions. It can dissolve your skeletal muscles, leading to kidney failure. You can get liver enzyme abnormalities. They don't say it leads to death. Adverse reactions. Most frequent. Headaches, aches and pains, tummy pain, and nausea. Now, I go through drug interactions with the population, screening information. Now, this is just general kind of summarizing information, but warning and precautions. And they do mention death as a possible outcome of taking this medication. And the shocking thing here is the people who make Crestor, they've taken off the gloves, dropped all pretense, and said, you know what? The following serious adverse reaction can happen at any dose. You know, they finally said, you know what, it can happen at any dose. There is no safe dose of this medication. Holy cow. Holy cow. And this is the number 4 selling drug in the United States. And the doctors are told, hey, this is just the way it is. There is no dose at which the deadly complications can occur. And this is very, very interesting. And that's the end of it. That's just what they say. And so there you have it. They're saying that you can get, you know, liver problems. And these can be deadly. You can get kidney problems. And these can be deadly, although they don't believe that they're associated with customers. So this is really amazing. And so there's not really much to say about it, except you have a drug here where it's admitted that the therapeutic dose is indeed the deadly dose. And I think that's something people need to really take seriously. And so we have here, we have no minimum beneficial dose. I guess it might be 5, because they tell you to start with 5 milligrams. And they don't say when you can expect this to benefit. So how long do you need to take Crestor before you present that first heart attack? And what's the maximum beneficial dose? They say 40 milligrams is the highest dose you should use. We're going to guess what's the maximum beneficial dose. And what's the minimum harmful dose? Again, it's not said, but we can deduce that the minimum harmful dose is somewhere around 5 milligrams or even less, because that's the starting dose. And at that dose, the side effects are experienced. So this is really a shocker. Okay. Questions from the chat room. My helper in the chat room is Rick. And so Rick's policing up all the questions for me so we can take questions. If anyone is listening has any questions, they can click their button there and we'll take questions. Okay, so the summary then is that the information necessary to determine the safety of medication is simply not given to them. They just don't have it. If you don't have the minimum harmful dose and you don't have the minimum beneficial dose, then your primary screen for safety, it doesn't exist. It's not there. So you have to just realize this. The minimum harmful dose, no information. The minimum beneficial dose, no information. Maximum beneficial dose. Again, the maximum dose that they're told, the doctors are told, it does keep changing. An excellent example is Prozac, and that dose is constantly increased. And even though patients are dying, the maximum dose keeps going up, even though people are dying at that maximum dose. And so it's simply not a maximum dose of safety. It's a maximum dose in which you can expect not to be sued. So if the PDR says the maximum dose is 40, you administer the maximum dose of 40, the patient dies, then you're practicing within the standard of care and that cannot be held legally liable or culpable. So this is the database that doctors have. Well, how can we apply this verbally? This is something I did when I was working with turpentine. But I was very, very concerned about safety. I realized that the drugs I was using or trained to use in medical school were absolutely deadly. I was very unhappy with the side effects that I saw patients experience. What I did was I developed the minimum beneficial dose. Now, I found the minimum beneficial dose was 1 teaspoon, but now that more and more people have used it, I found the minimum beneficial dose can be as low as 12 drops. That's very encouraging. And then the maximum beneficial dose, the dose that was using a higher dose but no further benefit, I found that was 1 teaspoon every single day. Beyond that, I did not personally see any benefit to anybody. Minimum harmful dose. Well, harmful, that would mean side effects. So I was very casual. Any side effect I considered to be harmful. What I found with turpentine was that if the person didn't have enough water and enough bowel movement, then one drop could give them side effects, which is dizziness or not feeling well. But once they had enough water and enough bowel movements on board, then the minimum harmful dose appeared to be a tablespoon. That's my observation. Now, onset of action for turpentine, anywhere from 10 to 30 seconds. Onset of harm, So if the person had taken an excessive dose, again, the same onset, 10 to 30 seconds, the person would know immediately that they had not done the right thing. The onset of benefit, again, so that's a little more. That could be anywhere from 30 seconds to 24 hours. But that's still pretty quick. And the minimum lethal dose for this, I had to look in the online research and government records. They say 2 tablespoons is the minimum lethal dose, lowest dose at which any individual has ever been known to die. Now, when I tracked this down, that was actually a child that died at that dose. We don't have the weight on that child, but you can presume a child is somebody under 100 pounds. LD10, dose at which 10% of all the take a die. Don't need that for turpentine because you're not going to even go above the minimum lethal dose. There's no need to because the therapeutic dose is so much lower. LD50, dose at which 50% of all take a die. Again, no need to go there because the therapeutic dose is so low. Beneficial dose is so low. Again, you can do this with any herb. You can do it with licorice root, with rosemary. And I encourage you to do that, to keep your herbs safe. And the minimum interval at which benefit is lost, the dose is not repeated. So early on when you use turpentine, that is 3 to 5 days. And once you get stabilized, by stabilized I mean once you get the full therapeutic benefit you're looking for, that duration is usually 4 to 6 weeks. And so, really challenge yourself to get to the bottom of it, to understand your medicine and to understand your herbs and what you're taking so that you can request this information. Keep it safe. Okay, so what's coming up for, first of all, update on Vitality Caps. Vitality Caps are not yet available for shipping. The original ship date was March 27th. The new expected ship date for Vitality Capsules is April 28th. My manufacturers have indicated it could be as early as April 15th, but I don't want to take any chances and give a date that might not happen. Now, the delay. The delay is my grinders for the ingredients became overwhelmed with the order, and we had to use a different process because the grinders could not handle it. So you'll still have great Vitality Capsules. They will be available. And April 28th. Anyone who orders before April 28th will receive an extra free bottle with their order at no charge. Okay, next week's show. Next week's show, by popular demand, is ayahuasca. Yes, ayahuasca. The incredible remedy from the Amazon jungle for the Peruvian area. And I'm going to talk about what ayahuasca is, how it's supposed to work, what it's believed to do, and I personally have taken ayahuasca on at least 6 occasions. A lot of ayahuasca. And I will share with you my experience taking ayahuasca, what the shamans recommended to prepare for ayahuasca, because that, by the way, is as important as the ayahuasca itself. And kind of what it was like each time. For those of you who don't care to catch a plane to Peru to experience ayahuasca, to know a little bit more about it firsthand. And I'll also talk about how I think it rates with other herbal experiences. Very unique experience of that, I can say for sure. So that's what we're going to talk about next week. The ins and outs of ayahuasca. Let's see what else. Okay. Oh, we have 5 more minutes. So if there are any questions, you can click on your things in the phone or if you can people in the chat room. So if there being no questions, I'm going to talk more about just how dangerous are. A big part of the reason why pharmaceuticals are dangerous is not so much that this information is not given. When this information is not given, then, of course, you can't use them safely. But for any substance, one can take the opportunity to go lower and lower and lower and lower on the dose to determine at which dose, no harmful effects are experienced, but he determined at least at which dose there are no deaths. And the information about the dose at which there are no deaths is easily obtained. We have poison control centers, and they get calls all the time. People call in and say, oh, my God, I took an extra blood pressure pill, or, oh, no, what should I do? They get all these reports. And then we look in the emergency room with these ingestions where they took too much of a drug, either by accident or deliberately. There's an estimation for how much was taken, and those records are kept, and they report back. They report either to the government or back to the poison control center what the dose was and if the patient lived or not. And so based on those reports, you can say, let's see, ingestions between the range of 100 milligrams and 1 gram were reported, and half of all the people who died, died at 200 milligrams. So this information is knowable. It is known. It is there. And if you've got the NSA bugging every phone call, if you now have medical records computerized, then this information should be available at the press of a button if somebody wanted to know. And so, or I should say, if somebody wanted the public to know, or if somebody wanted a doctor to know. And so we have to ask, why hasn't this been done? Why hasn't this information been gathered? Since all records are computerized, that means all the records in emergency rooms are computerized. And so you can just scan deaths from overdose, boom, what were the drugs, what was the dose taken, and all of a sudden you know which drugs people are dying from in terms of overdose. And you know what the dose is at which half of those who ingested it died, and that's important. Okay, we have a question. Hi, you're on the air. What's your name?
Hello?
Hello. Your name and where you're calling from?
My name is Grace Forto, and I'm calling from New York.
Uh-huh. What's your question?
My question really doesn't have to do with what we discussed today, but it's a question about what you talked about, the tapping sign that it creates worms, and the tap that is more afraid of worms. So my question is there any other method that you can use to do worms where you don't see the worms?
All right. I got it. You know, I used to think that, too. I used to say, can we get rid of these worms and not look at them? I would have to say, I feel very lucky that I've never seen any of my worms, but I'm sure some came out. The answer is you really don't want to break the worms open so that they're not recognizable. The worms have inside of them all of the extremely toxic and dangerous chemicals they've been eating for you over the years. So you want the worms to leave. And so the question is, how do you get the worms to leave so that you don't see them? I think the safest thing is not to look, but let's just say it's not really in your list of things to not do. You can use psyllium husk, and you can drink a lot of water with it. It's very important because the psyllium husk can cause you to be impacted if you don't drink enough water. But you can do that. Take psyllium, like a tablespoon with a pint of water, and that will form kind of a casing so that you can't really see the worm. But that would be the best way to do it. Okay, we have 60 seconds left. And so, again, next week is ayahuasca. Oh, and next week we'll be broadcasting from Sin Island, that's Focus Del Toro, the island of Sin. So I assure you I won't be sinning, but we'll be broadcasting from there. So we'll see you then. Okay,